This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, celebrating 40 years with the arrival of Anniversary Blend Coffee and Tea. Portland locations on the web at PEETS.com. This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Tiere has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, today is a nationwide day of solidarity in support of Lieutenant Aaron Watada, and we will feature an exclusive KBOO interview.
The U.S. government would store nuclear waste for up to 25 years on federal land under a proposal offered today to deal with growing volumes of used reactor fuel at nuclear power plants.
And Israeli troops have formed a massive buildup on the northern and southern borders of the Gaza Strip, stoking Palestinian fears of a possible Israeli invasion of Gaza.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,522 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports 42,889 civilians have been reportedly killed by military intervention in Iraq. The website InformationClearinghouse.info reports the true civilian casualty rate is as high as 250,000 dead.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 27th. I'm Noah Eaton.
And I'm Josonia Watson. A complaint says eight of this year's initiative campaigns are violating a ban on paying signature gatherers by the signature instead of by the hour. The complaint has been filed with the Oregon Elections Division. Tim Nesbitt and Elaine Lowell co-sponsored the 2002 initiative that led to the rule. Lowell says that they hope an aggressive investigation of the complaint happens quickly. Those in favor of the ban say that paying signature gatherers by the amount of signatures that they collect encourage fraud. Chief petitioners of initiative campaigns must sign statements indicating that they won't pay signature gatherers by the signature. July 7th is the deadline for turning in signatures to qualify initiatives for Oregon's November ballot.
Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court said it will take up the issue of whether Weyerhaeuser has established an illegal monopoly in the market for alder saw logs. The Bush administration and some of the biggest names in corporate America have weighed in against a lower court verdict against the corporation. In 2003, the jury found that Weyerhaeuser had used its market dominance to hoard alder saw logs and drive a small mill out of business. The jury awarded $26.25 million to the defunct Ross Simmons Hardwood Lumber Company of Longview, Washington, a sum that was automatically tripled to $78.75 million under federal antitrust law. More than a dozen other small mills followed on the verdict in securing settlements and judgments totaling about $50 million. Last year, a panel of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, based in San Francisco, unanimously upheld the finding.
Today is a nationwide day of solidarity in support of Lieutenant Aaron Watada, the Stryker Brigade officer from Fort Lewis, Washington, who refused to be deployed with his squadron to Iraq. Watada is currently being confined in a military jail without charges, awaiting an official court-martial. As we speak, supporters are gathering on the Hawthorne Bridge and will remain until 6 p.m. in Fort Lewis. Vigils are being held on every highway overpass. Supporters say more actions will be held until Watada's official court-martial, which has not yet been scheduled. On Saturday, KBOO's Mary Ann Barasonic spoke in KBOO studios with Watada. That interview was aired on Tuesday morning radio zone, and we excerpted it here.
I came to the decision that I could not, because of how the administration had deceived us and how they had violated international and domestic laws by waging this war and conducting it at the current time, that I could not, as an officer of conscience, a person of honor and integrity, participate in something as wrong as this war. And so in January, I submitted my letter of resignation, stating that I would rather resign out of protest than be forced to disobey any order. I never thought as an officer and a soldier that I would have to be forced into that situation. And of course, the chain of command came back and said, it doesn't really matter what you think or what you believe. Our president, our commander-in-chief has ordered us to go, and we're going to go, and that's the end of the story. And so over this time period from January until now, there's been an ongoing situation between myself and my commanders. Finally, they allowed me to submit an official letter of resignation. Official resignation packet. They said they would still recommend disapproval. And so it came back denied back in April. And before that, I already had legal counsel because they had already warned me that I was facing legal proceedings and investigation. I decided to speak out publicly because I felt it was my duty not only to disobey unlawful orders, but to speak out and show as an example to all members of the military that we do have a duty to evaluate the legality and the truthfulness behind every order, including the order to go to war, and then make the right decision for ourselves and the right decision according to our obligation to the Constitution, and no matter, regardless of the consequences. And so that's what I've done. I've spoke out publicly against this war, against the administration, in order to hold them accountable for leading us into it, and for the laws that we are breaking over there, and also just to give a certain amount of hope and inspiration to all Americans, those within the military and those without, that it is time for us to sacrifice something in order to ensure that our laws, our principles of democracy and freedom are upheld, and those who have threatened it are held accountable.
So the trial, will that be a court-martial? Will you go to jail?
Certainly. I've been told that I will be ordered to get on the plane to deploy to Iraq within the next few weeks. I've told them that from the very beginning that I will not get on that plane. I will refuse that order on the basis that it's unlawful. It's an order to go participate in an illegal war. And they said, okay, well, we will formally charge you on that day, and you will most likely face a court-martial. And probably pile on numerous charges. The most serious ones are disobeying a lawful order, missing movement by design, which means you plan to not get on the transportation to take you to wherever you're going to go. And those carry anywhere from 2 to 5 years max imprisonment. And also, after my incarceration, the Army would dismiss me with a dishonorable discharge. I would face a loss of all pay and allowances during that time. And pretty much, and the worst case thing for me is just the fact that there are many of my peers and soldiers that I work with that feel that I've betrayed them and that are angry and hate me for that. And
but see, you're looking at this as not a legal order. Can you talk a little bit about what the basis is for looking at this as an illegal war?
Certainly. As an American, we believe in certain principles according to our Constitution, according to what it means to be a democracy, which means a government by the people. And in the Constitution, the first three articles really spell out the responsibilities of each of the three branches of government. And to me, those principles define separation of powers, checks and balances, the things that are supposed to curb tyranny and absolute power at every turn. And to me, for the administration, which I think is clear to many people, and many people it's not as of yet, that the administration deceived the American public. They deceived the world. They deceived Congress into the premises of why we were invading a sovereign country. And to me, there's no greater crime than to betray the trust of the people to wage war and to sacrifice American lives for that, for whatever purpose. And so, yes, Congress did grant an authorization of force to the president. Now, they don't have, there are certain constitutional law experts who will say that Congress does not have that authority to relinquish their responsibility to declare war to the president. All it does is it gives the president more power and less oversight and accountability. Overall, it's just a clear violation of the separation of powers dictated by the Constitution. Also, there are, because this war was not based out of necessity, because there wasn't a clear and imminent threat, because it wasn't out of self-defense, it was still a preemptive war, it is a war of aggression. And wars of aggression are prohibited by the UN mandate and the Nuremberg Principles, both of which the United States has signed on to after World War II.
That was KBOO's Marianne Barasonic and Lieutenant Aaron Watata. For more information on his case, go to www.thankyoult.org.
President George Bush today staged a photo opportunity by jogging on the White House track with an Iraq War double amputee. The president and 23-year-old Staff Sergeant Christian Bagay, who hails from Eugene, Oregon, took several spins around the quarter-mile track despite intermittent drizzle. During a brief pause, Bush told reporters he ran the president into the ground. Bush met Bagay on a New Year's Day visit to Brooke Army Medical Center in Texas, where Bagay was recuperating after a roadside bombing in northern Iraq. One of Bagay's legs was amputated at the thigh, the other just above the ankle. But he asked Bush if he could run at the White House, and Bush agreed. Bush recalled thinking, "There's an optimistic person," but he says there was no doubt in Bagay's mind he could do it. Said Bagay, "It's a privilege."
Donations from people in eastern Oregon will buy four-foot powered sewing machines for a sewing co-op being formed in the town of Malapara, one of the poorest towns in Bangladesh. Parr and Michelle Sadar of Le Grand, who are organizing the purchase, said this week that the sewing machines will lift entire families out of poverty. The couple have visited Bangladesh many times. They say there are no clothing stores in Malapara, and people have to walk up to 10 miles to other towns to have material made into clothes, blankets, and pillows. The Treadell sewing machine will be the first for the town in northeast Bangladesh. Currently, all sewing and tailoring there is done by hand. The Sadars, who are raising the money with help from a local quilting club, said the effect on people's lives will be great because of the poverty of the region, which has high illiteracy and infant mortality rates.
The Portland School Board approved next year's budget last night, cutting school psychologist services. Officials say the budget keeps current class sizes and avoids cutting school days, thanks to $15 million in extra property taxes. The board unanimously approved the $405 million district-wide budget and the new taxes, authorized by the Oregon legislature during a special session last spring. The budget reduces the number of school psychologists by a third, freezes service and supplies budgets and cuts non-mandated bus routes. The budget adds new spending for textbooks and $6.3 million to cover recently settled contracts with classified workers and the district's 3,500 teachers. Also last night, the board approved leasing the closed Kenton Elementary School in North Portland to De La Salle North Catholic High School. The Catholic school will pay $320,000 a year with a 3% annual increase to lease Kenton, which closed last June.
For years, Oregon has dominated national rankings for the percentage of babies born at low birth rates. In 2000, just 5.6% of Oregon babies were born underweight. That's compared to 7.6% nationally. But this year, the state has slipped to number 3 in the rankings. 6.1% of the babies statewide were born underweight. This is according to a national report released today by the Baltimore-based N.E. Casey Foundation. Tina Kotek directs the Children's First for Oregon. She says the number likely reflects problems that pregnant women have been having in accessing prenatal care. She says the state has been struggling to increase the number of women with access to prenatal health care.
The Oregonian reports today that in one of the largest Measure 37 claims so far, a Portland man is asking Deschutes County for $200 million, or the right to develop his property inside Central Oregon's Newberry National Volcanic Monument. James R. Miller wants to drill geothermal energy test wells, expand a small mining operation, and build as many as 100 vacation homes on land he owns within a caldera. Miller, age 82, said county land use regulations and zoning enacted in the past 35 years have limited the property's potential.
The Castle Rock, Washington City Council voted 4-1 last night in favor of a resolution opposing a proposed mine 12 miles from Mount St. Helens crater. The resolution is not binding. The mine doesn't need the city's permission, but environmentalists hope it will be the first of several Lower Columbia communities to formally oppose the mine. Ryan Hunter of the Gifford Pinnock Task Force Conservation Group proposed the resolution the council approved, saying the proposed mine near an active volcano is a dangerous proposition. He also warned that acid rock drainage from the mine's leaching process could kill fish in area streams and contaminate Castle Rock's and Longview's drinking water. Spokane-based Idaho General Mines has asked for a federal lease on 900 acres of land near Goat Mountain for its mine. The proposed mine is just outside the federally protected Mount St. Helens National Volcanic Monument and is in the headwaters of the Green River.
The government would store nuclear waste for up to 25 years on federal land under a proposal offered today to deal with growing volumes of used reactor fuel at nuclear power plants. The waste sites could be built to accommodate a region or individual state, said aides to Senator Pete Domenici, Republican of New Mexico, as they prepare to put the proposal up for a vote by a Senate subcommittee that he leads. The proposal is aimed at addressing growing concern about the thousands of tons of used reactor fuel accumulating at power plants, waiting to be shipped off to an oft-delayed central government repository in Nevada. The proposed Yucca Mountain waste site, which would bury the used fuel deep beneath the earth, has yet to receive a license from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The Energy Department claims that currently it is barred from creating temporary waste storage facilities.
On the lighter side, a giant beetle unseen in the UK for 300 years and rare anywhere in the world has been discovered living in Wales. Startled workers at a furniture restore almost smashed the bug to bits with a hammer in their fear before cooler heads prevailed. Others believe the 2.6-inch long bug with two antennae up to 4 inches long was a child's plastic toy brought in as a joke. In fact, it turned out to be an extremely rare Capricorn beetle looking like a frightening throwback to the age of dinosaurs, though they thought that it had been extinct in the UK since 1700. Staff at Foothold Group in South Wales used recycled wood to make new furniture and saw the big bug crawl out of a pile of English wood. When it proved to be home to the beetle grub and second dead beetle, they were more fearful than pleased with their rare find. The beetle, which has a short lifespan, is expected to survive for only another 2 weeks. After its demise, the body will be donated to a National Museum of Wales, where it will be exhibited.
Beetlemania is back with a vengeance. Thank you, Josania.
Thank you.
A new study released today indicates that the country's top three purchased electronic voting machines are susceptible to fraud through software attacks. The study indicates that more than 120 security threats jeopardize the integrity of the machines, most of which were installed after the 2000 presidential election. FSRN's Anna Bogato spoke with Larry Norden, chair of the Brennan Center Task Force on Voting System Security, which conducted the study.
Now, how serious are these threats? What type of danger do they pose to voters here in the U.S.?
Well, one of the things that we were doing in this study was to attempt to prioritize what threats the public and election officials should be most concerned about so that we could implement the right kind of security measures. We identified 120 attacks, but we prioritized them and said there were certain ones with electronic voting systems, with that architecture, that we should be guarding against. And the threats specifically that we're most concerned about are threats where corrupt software, malware, is inserted onto voting machines and either changes votes or in some way affects election result totals. And that's something that we certainly think lawmakers and election officials should be concerned about, and they should be acting to protect systems. The good news is we found that, in fact, that is quite possible given the current technology, and it would not be a difficult thing to do.
And so how can those risks be reduced? How can those proposed changes really be implemented? Is that up to another task force? How does that work?
There are many ways that it could be done. And some of these things are already being done in a few states around the country. What we would like to see is something done either on the national level or at the state level across the country.
And it is a midterm election year. What does this mean? What could this mean this year? Do you think any of those proposed changes could actually be implemented before November?
I do. I'm actually very hopeful about that. We have 6 specific recommendations. Most of those recommendations can be applied to any of the current electronic voting systems that exist. They're not difficult, for the most part, to implement. And if they are implemented, I think the integrity of our elections will be substantially more secure. I should add that one of the things that we noted is this is not necessarily an issue of having a malicious attacker disrupt an election, although certainly I don't think we should discount the possibility that there are bad people in the world. We certainly looked at attacks at non-voting systems that have been successful against gambling machines, against government systems, against financial systems. But even taking that out of the equation, many, if not most, things that can happen because there's a malicious person involved can happen by accident. And what we've seen in the last several elections is often software bugs that result in incorrect totals, votes being lost. And again, if the procedures that we recommend are in place, our elections will be more reliable.
Larry Norden, chair of the Brennan Tent Center Task Force on Voting System Security, interviewed by FSRN's Ada Bogado.
In response to a Freedom of Information Act request, the Department of Defense has released documents that show wider surveillance of student organizations that previously reported the service members' Legal Defense Network has reported. On April 11th, the queer community website Page1Q reported that the Pentagon had admitted to conducting surveillance of groups protesting the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy for gays and lesbians in the armed forces. The document released today indicate that emails sent by various student groups were intercepted and monitored by the government. Further, the government collected reports from seemingly undercover agents who admitted at least one student protest at Southern Connecticut State University. None of the reports in the documentation, however, indicted any terrorists or indicated any terrorist activity by the students who were monitored.
Treasury Secretary-designate Henry Paulson pledged today to review a one-secret program that allowed the government to access a massive international database of financial information, allegedly to catch those who financed terrorists. Senator Max Baucus, Democrat of Montana, was upset that the administration did not brief the Senate Finance Committee on the terror tracking program. Last week's public disclosure of the program's existence angered the Bush administration, which said it could hobble efforts to shut down avenues for terrorist fundraising. In response to a request by Baucus, Paulson pledged to personally review the program after he takes the Treasury helm.
Veterans Affairs Secretary Jim Nicholson promised Congress today he could turn his agency into a model for information security, but he said lawmakers are going to have to be patient. Nicholson also said the Bush administration was asking for at least $160.5 million in emergency funds for credit counseling and other measures to protect veterans and military troops whose sensitive personal information was stolen. Besides covering credit monitoring for about half of the 17.5 million people whose Social Security numbers were compromised, the money would pay for out-of-the-pocket expenses for those whose identities are stolen. Veterans groups and lawmakers from both parties have criticized the VA about the theft and noted years of warnings by auditors that information security was lax. That data analysis, who was in the process of being dismissed, had taken the information home on a personal laptop for 3 years.
A constitutional amendment to ban flag desecration went to a vote in the Senate today, apparently heading for an outcome just short of the two-thirds needed to send it on to the states for ratification. Republicans scheduled the vote exactly 1 week before Independence Day, and a little more than 4 months before voters go to the polls to elect a new Congress. Democrats put forth an alternate that also was getting a vote. Sponsored by their party's assistant leader in the Senate, Dick Durbin of Illinois, it included much of the Republicans' language, but it would also make it against the law to damage an American flag on federal land if the intent was a breach of the peace or intimidation of other people. It also would prohibit unapproved demonstrations at military funerals.
A new ABC News Washington Post poll found that a majority of Americans disagree with the policy of indefinite detention without charge for prisoners at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Facility. 71% of those surveyed said that the Guantanamo Bay detainees should either be charged with a crime or given prisoner of war status. The U.S. government categorizes the detainees as enemy combatants. Only a handful of the approximately 500 Guantanamo Bay detainees have been charged with a crime. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez defended the U.S. government's policy towards the detainees as he began a tour of the Middle East today in Tel Aviv. The Supreme Court is expected to rule on this week on the Bush administration's power to try Guantanamo detainees in war crime tribunals.
Next Monday, Code Pink Women for Peace, Global Exchange and Gold Star Families for Peace will announce a historic hunger strike against the war in Iraq. At 5 p.m., they will sit down in front of the White House to eat their last meal and hold a press conference before beginning the fast at the same location in the morning of July 4th at 10 a.m. Hundreds of celebrities, veterans, mothers, and concerned citizens across the country will participate in a rolling fast. Strikers include musicians Willie Nelson and Michael Franti, actors Danny Glover, Sean Penn, and Susan Sarandon, Gold Star parents Cindy Sheehan and Fernando Suarez, and Code Pink co-founders Madea Benjamin, Jody Evans, and Gail Murphy. The fast will last until September 21st, International Peace Day, when activists around the country will initiate a week of nonviolent actions against the war as part of the Declaration of Peace.
The Bush administration will issue new regulations tomorrow clarifying what states can count when it comes to work participation under the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. Under the law, states are supposed to have at least half of their welfare recipients in approved work activities or face cuts in funding of up to 5%. However, states have been on their own in defining those work activities. Some have gone too far, the administration says. The government's accountability office said last year there were too many differences in how states defined work. For instance, of 10 states reviewed, 5 said caring for a disabled family member would meet work participation requirements. 5 did not. 6 states counted substance abuse treatment as work, but 4 did not. Such inconsistencies in definition make for unreliable comparisons when determining which states do a good job of helping residents find work, the GAO said.
21 states have raised the minimum wage since Congress did nearly 10 years ago. The federal minimum wage stands at just $5.15, and the Senate last week rejected a measure to raise it in phases to $7.25. FSRN's Luis Perez reports from California, where 2 bills have caused controversy between community advocates and business leaders on whether the minimum wage increase will affect the state's struggling financial situation more than it helps low-income workers.
Francisco Cerón is a minimum wage earning worker living in San Diego with 3 kids to support. Like many unskilled employees, Francisco has to work 2 full-time jobs at minimum wage just to make ends meet to support his family of 5. Every day, he cleans restaurants from 10 at night to 6 in the morning and cleans office buildings from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m.
I would like to see a raise in the minimum wage the same way prices go up. Just like gas prices go up, salaries should be raised so we can make a decent living and live decently.
California legislators are considering 2 bills that would raise the minimum wage $1 an hour in a period of 2 years and implement an indexing system of future increases, guaranteeing regular minimum wage raises on a yearly basis proportional to the state's inflation rate. 2 bordering states, Washington and Oregon, have already passed laws similar to AB 1835 and SB 1162, and use the indexing system to keep a balance between the minimum wage and the increase in the cost of living. Governor Schwarzenegger has agreed to raise the minimum wage from $6.75 an hour to $7.25 in 2006 and $7.75 in 2007. However, he is opposed to the systematic increases and has stated that he will veto any legislation containing the indexing system. According to Victoria Zamaha, head organizer of the San Diego chapter of the anti-poverty advocacy group ACORN, this is a maneuver to keep his popularity intact during the electoral season.
Salary raises shouldn't be used as political tools to benefit a certain candidate's interest during electoral season. It should be something according to the citizens' social and economic needs, especially those who work the most and do the hardest, toughest jobs that nobody wants to do but have to be done.
The 2 bills have caused controversy between community advocates and business leaders over whether the salary increases will affect California's struggling financial situation more than it helps low-income workers. The California Chamber of Commerce is opposing these bills, calling it unwise autopilot spending that eliminates the ability of decision-makers to consider all of the impacts each increase will have on employees and employers. The chamber believes that tying increases in the state minimum wage to inflation and ignoring other factors, such as the strength of the state's economy, will inevitably result in increases in the minimum wage at times when the economy is ill-suited to absorb higher employer costs. Gene Ross, executive director of the California Budget Project, a Sacramento-based NGO, which recently published a study outlining important facts about the minimum wage, suggests that most of the academic research that's been done on the impact of a modest minimum wage increase suggests that there is very little, if any, negative impact on jobs. The study also found that a minimum wage income does not buy as much as it used to. Gene Ross.
what we found is that since the purchasing power of the California's minimum wage peaked back in 1968, it's now declined. The minimum wage hasn't kept pace with inflation. And today, the minimum wage buys about a third less than it did back in 1968.
For now, Francisco and thousands of minimum wage earning workers are hoping for a positive turnout for the two proposed bills because it might be their way to a better life condition for his family.
Mi familia somos dos adultos y tres hijos.
We are two adults and three children living in a two-bedroom apartment, and we have to share a room so we can rent out the other and get some extra money to survive. I would like a raise in the salary according to the cost of living so I can make a decent living and move my kids to another place, maybe a little home.
In San Diego, this is Luis Perez for Free Speech Radio News.
The current time is 5:30, and now, time for another daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Contrary to the contrived wisdom of the powers that be, providing health care for everyone is not an economic or even a health issue. It's a moral issue. Notice that corporate chieftains and the political elites all have the Rolls Royce of health care, while most Americans are trying to make do with a sputtering Yugo, and while millions of our people are walking barefoot. This crass inequality on such a basic human need is a moral abomination. How is it that the richest country with the most democratic ideals of any country in the history of the world has 45 million people with no health coverage and millions more with pathetic coverage? And how is it that we the people pay $1.2 trillion a year to a corporate health care complex, more than any other people pay, and rank only 37th in the world in the quality of health care we receive? The powers that be just shrug their shoulders and say, well, sadly, America can't afford a system of good quality coverage for all. Can't afford it? George W. says America can afford the $1.2 trillion in tax giveaways he's bestowed on the wealthiest people in our land. He says America can afford the $300 billion in direct costs already shelled out for his war of lies in Iraq. He says America can afford the hundreds of billions of tax dollars being pocketed by drug companies and insurance giants through his boondoggle prescription drug program. Of course, our so-called political leaders don't feel the pain of America's corporatized and exclusive health system. The very politicos who say America can't afford universal coverage receive full platinum coverage for their families, courtesy of you and me. This is Jim Hightower saying, no public official should have even a dime's worth of coverage until every man, woman, and child in America has full coverage. For morality's sake, the President and the Congress ought to be last in line, not first.
This Jim Hightower commentary has been brought to you by the United Steelworkers, the union committed to winning every employee's right to choose representation free from fear of being intimidated or fired. Visit us on the World Wide Web at usw.org.
Howdy ho, this is Jim Hightower reckoning you better stay tuned for Independent Native News following our newscast. At 6 p.m. here out loud, followed by Prison Pipeline at 6:30. At 7, it's Amanda's Jam Corner. Tomorrow's weather, Portland mostly cloudy with highs near 80 degrees. And Columbia Gorge cloudy with temperatures reaching a mild 75 to 80 degrees. In other words, completely not like over the weekend, where it was as hot as a pair of jumper cables at a half-balloon tailgate party. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River. Woo!
The FBI has announced that it has dropped its demand for records from a library consortium in Connecticut. FSRN's Melinda Thuhurst reports from New Haven.
When four Connecticut librarians were served with a national security letter last year under the Patriot Act, it was accompanied by a gag order that prevented them from disclosing that the FBI had sought subscriber data, billing information, and access logs of their patrons. The librarians are all members of the Library Connection, a nonprofit consortium of 26 library branches in Connecticut. The American Civil Liberties Union handled the case. Roger Van, executive director of the ACLU's Connecticut chapter, says he's not surprised the government has now dropped the case, because once the Patriot Act was reauthorized, the government lost interest. During the reauthorization debate, the government had contended that libraries were not targets of investigation. The librarians who knew otherwise could not speak up because of the national security letter's gag order. Van says the Library Connections executive director, George Christian, wondered why he was the first to stand up since thousands of national security letters have been issued since 9/11.
And I think that's really the message here, and how scary the situation is today under which we live, that if not for the George Christians of the world and the other other clients that we have that we can now name, these issues may have never come to light.
National security letters act as subpoenas for information to a third party without a court order. Although the librarians have now been able to release the full text of the national security letter they received, many more documents pertaining to the case remain under seal. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
2 weeks after being evicted from a 14-acre urban garden in South Los Angeles, farmers and their supporters vow to preserve the space and deny they've relocated to different plots of land. Farmer Rocio Cardozo says the farmers, quote, have resolved to save this farm for our children and for generations to come, unquote. Cardozo says she represents a General Assembly of the 350 farmers evicted June 13th, when sheriff's deputies enforced a court order won last month by landowner Ralph Horowitz. Dozens of protesters were arrested in the eviction, including actress Daryl Hannah. Horowitz offered to sell 10 acres of the land for $16 million to a trust set up on behalf of the farmers, but the group was unable to raise the money before the option expired last month.
Two dozen U.S. senators, led by Senators Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, and Patty Murray, Democrat from Washington, have sent a letter to the chief executive of ExxonMobil, urging the oil giant to negotiate or pay up on the $4.5 billion punitive damages judgment stemming from the Exxon Valdez oil spill. About 3,000 plaintiffs have died waiting for their share of this judgment a federal court jury in Anchorage awarded them 12 years ago. The 24 senators who sign include Democrats Maria Cantwell of Washington, Mark Dayton of Minnesota, Dianne Feinstein of California, and John Kerry of Massachusetts. Among the Republican signers, Larry Craig of Idaho, Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island, and both senators from Maine. An Exxon spokesman said the company isn't stalling, just pursuing the case in court as allowed by law.
Investigators were trying to determine today whether Rush Limbaugh violated a deal with prosecutors in a long-running prescription fraud case when authorities found they had a bottle of Viagra that was apparently prescribed to someone else. Limbaugh was detained for more than 3 hours yesterday at Palm Beach International Airport after he returned on his private plane from a vacation in the Dominican Republic. Custom officials found Viagra in his bag, but his name wasn't on the prescription. Limbaugh's lawyer said the prescription was written in Limbaugh's doctor's name, quote, for privacy purposes, unquote. The conservative radio host was released without being charged, and investigators confiscated the Viagra, which treats erectile dysfunction. Last time Limbaugh was arrested for prescription drug violations, he had thousands of tablets of OxyContin, which causes erectile dysfunction.
Senator Spector wants to take President Bush to court, the Supreme Court. The senator is concerned with the excessive use of presidential signing statements. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
United States Congress versus the President of the United States.
I am seriously considering it.
Senator Arlen Specter is chair of the Judiciary Committee.
Of all the possibilities, that is the only one I think which has any practical import. These questions of standing are complicated. They really are complicated, more when they move into the area of case and controversy. But if there's an issue can be put to the court, I think it's worth doing. There's certainly enormous frustration, and the court is the arbiter.
Senator Spector is deeply concerned over presidential signing statements. Signing statements are addendums to laws to indicate how the executive branch plans to interpret the law. President Bush has defended his use of signing statements during times of constitutional confusion over presidential authority, especially during a time of war. White House spokesperson Tony Snow.
The same concerns about defending the presidential prerogatives when it comes to national security.
Signing statements serve a legitimate and important function and are not an abuse of power.
Michelle Boardman is Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice. She testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Congress need not fear signing statements, but should instead welcome the openness that they provide.
Republican Senator John Cornyn from Texas, a member of the Judiciary Committee, also defended the administration.
presidential signing statements, help inform the public debate as to precisely what it is the executive intended and exactly what the legislature has intended.
But most senators at the hearing interpreted signing statements as another example of abuse of inherent powers and the disregard of Congress. Democratic Senator Edward Kennedy from Massachusetts.
Shouldn't we be entitled to know which laws on the books now that he's not going to enforce because he believes that they're unconstitutional, and yet he's not going to tell us, he's not going to tell the American people which laws he's not going to enforce?
The president has added nearly 800 signing statements to laws. That is compared to just over 100 by President Clinton and more than all addendums by all presidents combined. An example, the Patriot Act says the Justice Department must inform Congress of private searches and seizures. The signing statement says the Justice Department does not have to brief Congress if national security could be compromised. Another, the law forbids the U.S. military from participating in combat against rebels in Colombia, except in cases of self-defense. The signing statement says that law is simply advisory. Senator Kennedy is seeking oversight legislation.
Seems to me we ought to be able to find out in a bipartisan way, at least legislatively, what in the world this president is going to say is going to be enforced and what he is not going to enforce.
But the president could add a signing statement to that law. So Senator Spector wants the courts to intervene. The courts have never ruled on the constitutionality of signing statements. Charles Ogletree is a professor of law at Harvard University.
I think not only can you, I think you must. If the view is going to be that these are harmless, simple interpretations of law and the president's authority cannot be checked, I see no alternative except to let the court decide. That's what Marbury versus Madison told us many years ago, and I think that's what this Supreme Court may have to tell us now.
Congress would have to pass a statute to take the president to court. Only once has the Congress done this. That was during the Nixon administration over a budget issue. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leon Caldwell.
Palestinian factions have announced that they plan to form a national unity government within 2 weeks, with Hamas agreeing to a document that implicitly recognizes the state of Israel. The agreement comes as Israeli troops have formed a massive buildup on the northern and southern borders of the Gaza Strip, stoking Palestinian fears of a possible Israeli invasion of Gaza. An Israeli airstrike this afternoon in Gaza City killed one Palestinian and injured another. FSRN's Syed Benora reports.
In the midst of the wrangling over the fate of the soldier, the settler, and the 1.3 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip, the Palestinian leadership has managed to come to an agreement for a national unity government. Sami Abu Zuhri, spokesperson for Hamas.
We said from the beginning that this unity document contains a number of positive points. The differences between the factions are limited and specific. And through our meetings with all factions, we managed to resolve the differences and agree to mutual standards for unity. This document is very clear. It does not recognize the legitimacy of the Israeli occupation.
The National Unity Government calls for negotiations with Israel if Israeli forces pull back and end their 40-year occupation of Palestine. After an Israeli soldier was captured by Palestinian resistance fighters Sunday, Israeli tanks have lined up, apparently preparing for a wide-scale invasion. In Jabalia refugee camp, residents are trying to protect themselves by fortifying the entrances with dirt and rocks. Hisam Yunis is the director of the Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights.
I believe the Israelis will conduct a large-scale operation, and they will not hesitate, because their attacks against the Palestinian people have been ongoing, even before this latest development. There has been shelling, assassinations, and a siege imposed upon us for months now. Therefore, nothing much has changed. The decision to escalate is theirs, but this is a new escalation. Several years ago, when soldier Nachum Volksman was abducted, an Israeli force broke into the location where the abducted soldier was being held. The soldier and his abductors were all killed in the attack. Such a scenario might be repeated, where an Israeli attack results in the death of the soldier.
Palestinian resistance groups in the West Bank claim to be holding a second Israeli prisoner, a settler from the illegal Israeli settlement of Itamar, with whom they hope to gain leverage in the negotiations with Israel. Secret negotiations that have apparently gotten nowhere so far. أبو عبيدة is with the Qassam Brigades in the West Bank.
There is popular pressure on us to not release the soldier, and the people have confirmed that they can face this latest Israeli aggression, especially since the aggression against the Gaza Strip has not ceased. The Gaza Strip will be a hard nut to chew for the occupation, and will remain a thorn in the throat of the enemy. If the Zionist enemy wants to enter the Gaza Strip, let them try and see how the resistance will respond. There will be many surprises that will astonish the Zionist enemy. Our fighters managed to enter the heart of the Kerem Shalom military base of the Israelis on Sunday. These fighters will teach the enemy a lesson they will never forget if the Israeli army invades the Gaza Strip.
In return for the release of the soldier and settler, Palestinian resistance groups are demanding the release of the Palestinian children and women being held in Israeli prisons. Families of prisoners have carried out nonviolent marches throughout Palestine urging the release of their loved ones, and 1,200 prisoners in the Negev began a hunger strike today. And the Israeli peace bloc Gush Shalom issued a statement that the Israeli soldier is not a victim of kidnapping but a prisoner of war, and urged Israel to release Palestinian detainees. Uri Avniri, the director of Gush Shalom.
I would say that at this moment it all depends on President Bush and the United States government. They are the only ones who have the power to induce the Israeli government to take a different line. It's also a question of the propaganda war, because I see many media around the world do not describe this action for what it is, a military operation, but as a terrorist act designed to kidnap an Israeli, ignoring that about 20 Palestinian civilians were killed in the last few weeks.
The Israeli daily Yedaot Ahronot reported today that Israel plans to cut off the electricity and water supply from the Gaza Strip in an act of collective punishment of Palestinians for the seizure of the soldier. This is Saad Bannoura reporting from imemc.org for Free Speech Radio News in Beit Sahur, Palestine.
Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said Iran does not need talks with the United States over its nuclear program because nothing would be gained, said sources reported today. He said Iran was willing to hold talks on its own terms, warning that the West can misuse the negotiation process to bar Tehran from what it considers its right to pursue enrichment.
The U.S. military issued a sober assessment today of the Baghdad security crackdown, saying violence had decreased slightly but not to, quote, the degree we would like to see, unquote, in the 2 weeks and 75,000 Iraqi and American troops flooded the capital. The evaluation came as 18 more Iraqis fell victim to sectarian and insurgent violence, including five people whose bodies were found dumped in Baghdad. The U.S. military also announced the deaths of a Marine and three soldiers. Three of the deaths were west of the capital in Volatil Anbar province, an insurgent stronghold. Major General William Caldwell, spokesman for U.S. forces in Iraq, said the overwhelming security operation launched 2 weeks ago to rein in violence in Baghdad was moving more slowly than hoped.
Italy's ruling coalition agreed today to withdraw as many as 400 soldiers from Afghanistan, dealing another blow to U.S.-led military efforts overseas, according to reports. The government already has committed to pulling out all its troops from Iraq by year's end. Premier Romano Prodi's coalition approved pulling out as many as 400 of Italy's 1,300 troops in Afghanistan. The remaining soldiers will focus on civil duties, officials said after lawmakers met with foreign ministers Massimo D'Alema and other officials. Italy's contingent is stationed in Kabul and Herat. But the NATO expanding its mission into Afghanistan's volatile south, the government has been reviewing the level of its commitment. Spina said Italian soldiers would remain engaged in Kabul and Herat, but not participating in NATO's expanding mission.
New changes to India's criminal code could free tens of thousands of pretrial detainees, FSRN's Binu Alex reports.
A staggering 50,000 pretrial detainees are languishing in Indian jails, many serving terms far exceeding the sentences they would have been given had they been convicted of crime. Most of these detainees remain in prison due to either lack of knowledge about their legal rights, poor legal assistance, or long delays in the judicial system, But changes to India's criminal laws that came into effect last Friday could lead to the release of thousands. The new law dictates that pre-trial detainees, with the exception of those potentially facing the death penalty, must be released if he or she has been in jail for longer than half the time that would be prescribed as a prison sentence. According to the latest figures of the National Crime Record Bureau, 67% of the inmates in Indian prisons are under pre-trial detention. Judicial activists said the amendments were a step towards the decongestion of countries' overcrowded prisons. From Ahmedabad in India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
President Vladimir Putin agreed United States today to open talks on a weapons treaty to replace the new Key START agreement. Less than 3 weeks before meeting President Bush in St. Petersburg, the treaty signed in 1991 by the United States and the Soviet Union limits the number of various types of vehicles and warheads that would be deployed by either side, and it contains measures both sides can take to inspect and verify reductions. The agreement, which also provides verification procedures for the subsequent 2002 Moscow Treaty on Strategic Reductions, expired in December 2009. Daryl Kimball, executive director of the private Washington-based Arms Control Association, said neither the United States nor Russia has shown much interest in a follow-up treaty. He called Putin's call very, very significant.
Fierce fighting across southern Afghanistan killed 29 suspected militants, two British soldiers, and two Afghan troops, officials said today. A suicide car bomber killed two civilians in the north. The British forces came under attack early Tuesday in the Sangreen Valley of southern Helmand province, where Britain has some 3,300 troops, the British Defense Ministry said. Two British soldiers were killed and one wounded in the firefight, said military spokesman Captain Drew Gibson. Five suspected militants were also killed. The violence comes amid the largest coalition military offensive since the Taliban regime's ouster in late 2001. Militants have been increasing attacks in southern Afghanistan in recent months.
Two United Nations peacekeepers kidnapped by rebels in the Democratic Republic of Congo have been released. The Nepalese men were two of seven seized a month ago during an operation to disarm militia in the northeastern Ituri region. The DRC has the largest UN peacekeeping force in the world, with around 17,000 troops based there ahead of the first multi-party elections in 40 years, which take place next month.
Panama's President Martin Torrijos is to call a referendum on whether the Panama Canal should be expanded. Earlier in the year, the government announced a $5.3 billion plan to expand the canal intended to keep it competitive. Around 40 ships a day pass through the 80-kilometer waterway, which links the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. But canal's capacity has now become stretched, partly because of surging exports from China.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 27th. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland and Corvallis at 100.7 FM on transmitter K264AA and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producers for tonight's newscast is Angela Hancock-Revis, with assistant producers Ross Egan and Jill Severinsen. Our AP Wire editor is Dwayne Ponce. Tonight's audio editors were Noah Eaton and Ross Egan. Special thanks to reporters Marianne Barasonic, our engineer Judy Fisto. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Josonia Watson.
And I'm Noah Eaton. Stay tuned for Independent Native News.